You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Hi, just a couple of housekeeping notes before we start. Although the Second City's live theater and live classes are not happening, we have turned everything virtual. You can take Second City classes in writing, in improv, and acting. There's a kids camp. We're also doing virtual corporate webinars and keynotes and workshops. It's all really kind of amazing, everything that we've been able to turn around. Plus, Second City is offering live improv shows on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You can get all that information at www.secondcity.com. Check it out.
Before we start the episode today, I need to give you a trigger warning. There is content in our conversation with Valerie Kaur where racial slurs are said and there's talk of sexual violence. This is all in the context of things that Valerie herself has experienced. It's a really honest and raw and powerful conversation, but if those things are going to trigger you, maybe skip this one. Thank you.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Valerie Kaur. Valerie is a civil rights activist, award-winning filmmaker, lawyer, faith leader, and founder of the Revolutionary Love Project. Her social justice campaigns have helped win policy change on hate crimes, racial profiling, immigration detention, solitary confinement, marriage equality, and internet freedom. She founded Groundswell Movement, the Yale Visual Law Project, and Faithful Internet, initiatives that equip new generations with tools for social change. During her work inside Supermax prisons on the military base at Guantanamo and at sites of mass shootings, she identified a surprising key element for social change, the ethic of love. She has a new book. It's called See No Stranger, a memoir and manifesto of revolutionary love. Valerie Kaur, welcome to the show.
I'm so delighted to be here with you, Kelly. Thank you.
All right. I'm going to admit to you that I was not really aware of the details of your work when I booked you on the podcast. my friend Dolly Chug at NYU had posted a link about your new book on Facebook, and I reached out to your publishers on a hunch. So I finished your book on Sunday, and I literally had to step outside and sit in my garden to reflect on the journey you took us on and how oddly connected I felt to that journey. In part because the first words of the book are, quote, "This book is for anyone who feels breathless," end quote. And Saturday will be the 1 year anniversary of our daughter Nora's death. And I have felt breathless an entire year.
Oh, Kelly, I just want to reach through the screen and hug you, brother.
We're not allowed to touch.
I know. Just when we need each other more than any time, right?
No, exactly. And I've had friends who passed away during this pandemic. And while the Zoom memorials are lovely, it's not the same.
Yes.
And there's so much in this book of, well, first sitting with yourself, sitting with your past, sitting with your past generations, sitting with their stories, sitting with people in pain, and breathing. And I know when I shared this information with Juliana in your office, the first thing she said to me back was, I'm breathing with you.
Yes.
Which was really lovely.
Yes. Yes.
So talk to us about revolutionary love, just this concept. Actually, you say in the book, it's how we stay in the fire. So I don't know if we need to talk about the fire first, but I think most people understand what the fire is right now, right?
Yes. Well, a few years ago, after this president first took power, you know, at that point, I had just become a new mother and I had been in the labor for justice as a civil rights activist since September 11th. And, you know, with every film, with every lawsuit, with every campaign, I thought we were making the nation safer for the next generation. And suddenly we are in a new era that white nationalists claim as their great awakening. And I felt breathless.
Yeah.
And I realized that the last time I was that breathless was on the birthing table.
Yeah.
And so this question arose in me, this question around, is the darkness that we are experiencing right now in our country and in our world, is this darkness the darkness of the tomb or the darkness of the womb?
Mm-hmm.
What if our America is not dead, but a nation still waiting to be born? The midwife says to breathe and to push, to breathe and to push. And so when I first delivered those words, that video of that address was my watch night address, New Year's Eve of 2016. It went viral. It was like 40 million people around the world. And they were asking me, they were saying, we're in, but how do we breathe? Yeah. How do we push? How do we labor for justice when the labor feels endless?
Yeah.
And I realized I had to answer those questions for myself more than anyone else. And so I was given a gift that very few women who are mothers or activists are ever given. I was given time off mm-hmm. and a room of my own. And I spent a year with my family in the rainforest, breathing, really taking my first full deep breath that I had taken in a very long time. And pouring through the stories of my life, pouring through social movements of the past, pouring through wisdom traditions, looking for the answer. And I began to see these patterns that I started to call practices of revolutionary love, that our ancestors knew how to breathe. Our ancestors knew how to push, and it means grieving with each other mm-hmm. and fighting for each other and raging with each other and reimagining with each other. And so I consolidated all of this wisdom into this book. So really, Kelly, I wrote this book for my own survival.
Right.
So I could find a way to come back to the country and keep going. And little did I know, in a time of, you know, global pandemic, in the midst of a national reckoning for racial justice with the 2020 election on the horizon, that I would need the practices in this book more than anything else.
Yeah.
So yes, breathing together.
Well, and you know, the idea of the personal and the political, this is certainly something I remember starting at Second City. It is in the late 80s, and the founders were still there, and talking to them about the sort of politics of what we do. And Bernie Solins, who was the co-founder, had said to me that all politics are personal. And mm-hmm. when you can share the stories on stage of the events that happen in the kitchen, and recognizing that those are the events that are happening in the boardroom and that are happening in Washington, D.C., in the halls of justice, like that we can learn that's how we get to understand what's going on. And what I loved about the book and what I love about what's going on right now is it's all mixed.
Yes.
It's all mixed, and it's messy, and it's tough. And this idea, I've long sort of said that people don't use the term love enough in the business world, and it's the most powerful thing we have, but they're scared of it because it's hard. And you say in the book, quote, loving only ourselves is escapism. Loving only our opponents is self-loathing. Loving only others is ineffective. All three practices together make love revolutionary, and revolutionary love can only be practiced in community. What that says to me is we're stuck with each other.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. No matter who gets elected in November, we're all still going to be here the day after the election. So how do we transition the country into a country where we see no stranger? That requires labor.
Yeah.
And my intervention is to say, well, just as social reformers in the past, thinking about John Lewis, who just died, and he divided his entire life into these practices of revolutionary love. If Dr. King, if John Lewis, if they showed us what love looked like in that generation, then what does it mean for us as a new generation to reclaim love as a force for justice? And I have to be honest, like, I'm trained as a lawyer. So anytime anyone ever said love was the answer, I would roll my eyes. You know, I would say, sure, you know, thoughts and prayers, You're right. Where's the action in the face of systems of injustice? And it was going to the rainforest and pouring through these histories and these wisdoms that I said, oh, the problem is not with love. It's the way that we talk about it. You know, we use romantic love as our reference point. We fall in love. It's something passive that happens to us. But, oh, gosh, you know, this moment, Kelly, is the moment when I really woke up to love is labor. My son was born and he was placed on my chest. And I was just shaking and sobbing from like the rush of oxytocin flooding through my body, right? I'm falling in love. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, my mother is next to me and she's opening up her bag and she's taking out her dal and her chol and she's feeding me, like feeding her baby as I'm feeding my baby. And I looked at my mother and I said, oh, she's never stopped laboring for me.
Right.
From my birth to my son's birth and now my daughter's birth. She knew what I was just beginning to wake up to, that love is labor. It's fierce, it's bloody, it's imperfect. Feelings come and go. Grief is the price of love. Joy is the gift of love. Rage is what we harness to protect that which we love. I mean, all of the emotions are part of the labor of caregiving. And so what might it mean to extend that kind of love as labor beyond our own kin, like beyond what evolution requires, to others, to our opponents, to ourselves, who we too often neglect? That's what I define as revolutionary love.
I mean, this is, you know, in the last weeks of Nora's life, we had to feed her.
Hmm.
And going back to that.
Yes.
And she had a hankering for, my wife Ann makes this, what we call kindergarten soup. It's from the Chicago Waldorf catalog, because I have Waldorf kids. And so she'd go and make batches of soup. And actually, there was this period where Nora really wanted to eat. It was just like 3 weeks before she died. And so it was so, like, such a great sort of honor, but also the sort of full circle thing that I think of.
Yes.
And I remember a few months after she died, Anne and I penned this op-ed for the Chicago Tribune, which was very much speaking about, because this is when the kids were getting thrown in cages. And we had just lived at Lurie Children's Hospital, where women with hijab and other people speaking Spanish or whatever, like, you hold the door, the elevator door, for everyone. I don't care who you, everyone does. And people who share nothing outside of those walls, the minute you're inside those walls, everyone has a sick kid.
Yes.
And it's like, and it's like, you know, why isn't this the way we behave all the time in society? Mm-hmm. And why are we doing the opposite now politically? And it is a very hard love, and it is very difficult to sort of see the people, the inhumanity that is being rendered on people, and still trying to see these people as human. But I think your book is calling for that, because I think you're saying that there's no way out of this unless we regain the humanity. And that's all of us, because we all have monsters and angels within us.
Yes. Yes, that's it.
You grew up on a farm in Clovis, California, and you write, quote, we belonged to the land. How so?
Oh, gosh. I remember my first memories, Kelly, were just looking up at that night sky and seeing the Milky Way stretch across. You know, in the country, we could see the stars every night, and I would talk to the stars as if they were my friends, and I could feel the earth beneath my feet, the horses and the cows and the butterflies. And so what I say in the book is that when we remember the kind of wonder that we once experienced as children, then we return to that kind of knowledge that we could look upon anything around us and say, you are part of me, I do not yet know. Mm-hmm. You are a part of me, I do not yet know. And I think that initial orientation to wonder, that interconnectedness, gets severed sooner or later in life. And perhaps our life journey is a return to that initial knowledge that we carried.
Yeah, well, because you, I mean, it's not like you, I mean, you were very different in that part of the country.
Yeah, so it happened quite soon for me.
Yeah.
I was 6 years old when I heard my first racial slur. My family had lived and farmed on the land in California for almost a century. And yet, within moments of, you know, really starting my life in school, I saw myself through the others who saw me as foreign or suspect, and much later in the aftermath of 9/11 as a terrorist.
Right. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Dr. Keltner at Berkeley, but he has done a lot of research around how some disadvantaged communities, poor people, are often far more reliable narrators of the truth because they have to be. and you write in the book, a quote, "I discovered the margin can be a space of strength. I could see what others could not see." And that reminds me of that. That's what I think you're kind of getting at.
Yes, yes. I always despised being on the margins. I wanted to be fully white and fair and accepted in that community. Or I'm third generation Sikh American. So then my name is a very English American name. I was born on Valentine's Day. That's how I got my name. So I wanted to change my name to Simran and learn Punjabi fluently and be fully seen as Punjabi Sikh. I felt in between. And that in-betweenness I despised until much later I learned, the margins is a space of strength. I can see things that others can't. I can tell stories from the space. So really the book that you're holding in your hand, See No Stranger, is a story told from the margins and therefore a story drenched in truth.
Yeah. So after 9/11, you had your university canceled your trip to Punjab, right? You were supposed to go there. You pivoted. You improvised. And you and your cousin started visiting Sikh families all over the country who had been subject to violence and sat and recorded their stories.
Right. Balbir Singh Sodhi, a Sikh father, was the first person to be killed in a hate crime after 9/11. And he was someone my family knew. And so it became very personal. The political is personal, as you're naming. And I, for myself, you know, as much as for my community, I had to do something with the kind of energy and the grief inside of me. I had to channel it into some kind of action. And I had no idea what I was doing, but I took a leave of absence from school. I grabbed my camera. I was 20. And I began to cross the country capturing these stories in our community. And that is the beginning of how I became a civil rights activist.
So I don't know if you know this about improvisation, but almost all sort of beginning level improvisation is focused on listening, because we don't do it well, just generally speaking. And so there are a variety of exercises, one of which is called Last Word, where if we're having a conversation, the first word of your sentence back to me has to start with the last word I said.
Wow.
You to listen to the end of the sentence.
Wow. And not be thinking, well, okay, what am I going to say next? No, you have to listen to the very end. That is the definition of deep listening.
Exactly. And then you just take a beat. I mean, this is the thing. It's more simple than if you just approach it with these sort of like hacks, which is what improv does. But listening is such a big part of this book. And you say in the book, it's not easy to listen.
No. No, because it risks being changed by what we hear. It's an act of surrender. And in what you're naming the world of improv, it will also shape your response. If you listen that deeply, then it should shape what happens next.
Because we have no script.
Right.
We are making the script together.
Right.
In front of an audience, a bunch of prying eyes. So the only thing I've got when I'm improvising is you and your words and your thoughts to build upon. And the only thing you have is my words and thoughts to build along. And what we talk about is the need to be fiercely present in the moment, because that's the only way we do this thing.
So then my book is filled with stories about how to do that when you're sitting with a white supremacist.
Yeah. So,
or with a prison guard, or with a soldier, or with your former abuser, someone you do not want to listen to. And yet, how do you stay and listen to the very end of their sentence? How do you be brave enough to be changed by what you might hear and still know that it is not granting them legitimacy, it's granting them full humanity, and it's preserving your own? That's what revolutionary love is. It's rooted in this act of radical wondering and deep listening, which I didn't realize improv was teaching all this time.
So tell us that story from the book about you were in a Mexican restaurant. Was it El Paso, I think, and the table next to you was using racial slurs, and you got up and talked to this group of guys.
Yeah. Talk about improv. I'm sitting writing about revolutionary love at this table. It was actually in El Porto. Here in the South Bay in Los Angeles. So seaside, you know, little town. And I heard the word, and I apologize, but I want you to hear it because this is what the pain it caused in my body. I heard sand nigger. And my body seized up and I wanted to leave. And I thought, well, I'm writing about revolutionary love, about seeing no stranger. I want to see that table as bigots, but what if they were my uncles? What would I say to my uncles? And so I walked over to the table of five grown men hunched over their beers. And I said, I just need you to know that people in my life have been killed to that word. And that's what it means to me. And at first they were very defensive. And I said, well, if you continue to use those words as the lens through which you see people who look like me, then you'll never see me as a niece or as a daughter. And I came here because I saw you as my uncles. And that created a little bit of a shift. And then, you know, the encounter goes on. I don't know if you want to go there, but at the end of it, I thought, well, somebody needed to walk over to that table. Somebody needed to confront those men. I'm just not sure it had to be me. I don't know if I was safe enough to do that. And I think about the role of what revolutionary love means right now. All of us have different roles in the labor for justice. And for those who are, you know, if you have a knee on your neck right now, it is not necessarily your job to look up and wonder about your oppressor or try to listen to them. Right. Your job is to survive and to take the next breath. There may be other people who, by virtue of their skin color or their privilege, can do that work of tending to those wounds and listening to those people. So I think so much when you talk about listening, so much about revolutionary love is listening for what our role is in any given moment.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I was talking yesterday with my friend Liz Joint Sandberg, who teaches at Second City and is in the abolitionist movement and wants to do improv training for these folks because they've actually brought up things like the yes and concept, but don't quite get it. And she asked the question of, you know, how can we ask people, especially Black and Brown people, to love their, you know, opponents or do this work? And I said, oh, I just read this book. And she was very excited that I was interviewing you. Very excited. And I said that it's in the book. And it's basically, if you're able to do the work, you can do the work if you're privileged to do that. And we have a concept in improvisation called follow the follower, which actually has some roots in social activism and out of Brazil. Theater for the oppressed. But it's the idea that we lead by following, we follow and we lead, that we're constantly shifting based on circumstances. You've probably heard that phrase, like your team is only as good as its weakest member. And we change that. What we say is your team is only as good as its ability to compensate for its weakest member, because each of us is going to be the weakest member at some time.
Yes. And
I think this is the message, which is you are there for the fight unless you can't be. But that is never a static situation, or rarely is one that sometimes you should be able to and sometimes you won't be able to. And you tell that in your story because it's very dramatic in terms of the stuff that you've gone through.
Yes. I mean, even my ability to leave for a year after this president took power, I felt so much guilt about that. I'm like, I should be on the front lines. I should be fighting. And the truth is there were many young advocates who could now step into the front lines and I was making space for them. And I could come back with tools now for ways that they can last. You know, I've had to learn that there are different seasons in life and there are different roles that we ought to play, and that discerning our role in any given day and in any given moment and in any given season of life is what it means to also have longevity.
There's a really lovely moment because you have as we all do, a complicated relationship with your mother. And it's when you're talking about forgiveness. And your mom says, quote, forgiveness is for you, not for the person who hurt you.
Yeah.
I've never heard it phrased quite that way. And I imagine you hadn't either up until that time.
No, I mean, I remember it was my grandmother's deathbed, my mother's mother-in-law, who had only, you know, she was kind to everyone else, but she was cruel to my mother and for so many years of her life. And here I walk into the room and my mother is swabbing my grandmother's mouth and giving her last sips of water and praying with her. And it was such a loving act and such a peaceful act and an act of reconciliation that just came from my mother's, I couldn't understand it. And after my mother spread my grandmother's ashes, I asked her, well, how did you do it? How could you do it? And she said, that's when she said, forgiveness is for you, not for them. You see, forgiveness for my mother was liberation. You know, forgiveness is not forgetting. Forgiveness is freedom from hate. And sometimes we need to cling to that animosity. And so I respect any survivor who says, I'm not ready to forgive. And that's an act of agency, right?
Yeah.
But then there might come a time when you forgive beyond all expectation, and it's for your own sense of freedom. And I then begin to figure out, like, I have, you know, I tell the story about surviving a sexual assault in the book. And for 20 years, I was not willing to forgive my abuser until I was. Until I had raged enough and grieved enough and received enough love and breathed enough and healed enough to say, I want to do this for myself. And so and in the very end of the book, you see this story about, well, the personal is political, right? So how do we take that kind of notion of forgiveness into the realm of criminal justice? We called Bilbir Uncle's murderer and began the process of forgiving him. 15 years after Bilbir Uncle's murder. So I tell these stories because I believe that the practices of revolutionary love, you know, they open up possibilities that are previously inconceivable, and that transition a family, transition a community, maybe even transition a country into something new.
I love the chapter headings. They're things like listen, reimagine, breathe, push, and transition is at the end. You say, quote, transition is an imperfect metaphor. There is no one point when a new society is born. We always find ourselves in the middle of a cycle, which is one of the reasons I think we find it hard to do these things. Because we're such linear people. We're always like, I need
totally.
Where does this begin? It's like, no, we're in it. And we were in it before we knew we were in it. So how do we wrestle with this, like the sort of complex sort of just day-to-day narrative and the vision narrative and all the change around us, and especially now when we're doing all of this in a global pandemic? I mean, you point to it in the book without telling us what it is, I think. And I think that point is revolutionary love and all that comes with it. But I also feel like the sequence of your journey and the way you're sort of the order in which you're telling the story gives us at least some idea of what the arc of that path might look like.
Yes. Right? Yes. Well, you know, I always had Dr. King's voice in my ear when I was a little girl, like the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Right. And so, but we never were told the shape of that arc. And I always had just a straight line, you know, straight line of linear progress. And that fell apart for me after 9/11, and certainly since 2016, and certainly now for so many more people. And I realized, like, if we're thinking about progress as linear, then we're sliding backwards into darkness. But if we, remember I said, like, the story of America is one long labor. So progress during birthing labor is cyclical, not linear, it is cyclical. Since George Floyd's murder, so many of these images have looked like 1968. They've looked like 1992. But every generation that decided to labor, to breathe, and to push opened up a little bit more space for equality and justice and solidarity than there was before. And so to see images now of white people standing in front of black people kneeling in the street in front of an army of police officers, those images we've never seen before. I think every turn through the cycle gets us a little bit closer to what is wanting to be born. And here's the thing, just like in birthing labor, you don't know how many more cycles it's going to take.
Right.
And I don't know. I mean, will I see it in my lifetime? Will my children see it in their lifetime? And all I know is that I have the responsibility simply to show up in my moment in the cycle, to breathe and to push and to have a kind of faith that we are getting a little bit closer every time if we do our parts.
I was having a conversation in the car with my son, Nick, who's 22, just graduated college, hoping to be a stage actor. Not a lot of those jobs right now. And very aware politically and in the news, and was sort of saying to me, like, he toggles between looking at history and wondering, you know, are human beings just like this and it'll never get better? Or are we capable of change? And I had on a writer who cited an anthropological study, which I thought was fascinating, which if you go back far enough, we weren't initially warring as groups. We were caring.
Yes.
We were caregivers. everyone. And that you know, it changed with the agrarian revolution, among other things. But that, if you actually want to go back far enough, I think the seeds are there for us to potentially actually do this thing.
Yes. And hasn't the call to love been on the lips of indigenous leaders and spiritual teachers for so many centuries?
Yes.
The call
yes.
to expand that circle of who counts as one of us. And so if we're showing up with revolutionary love is simply the choice to be brave enough to see no stranger, to see mm-hmm. George Floyd as brother, Breonna Taylor as sister, to see your daughter as my daughter, for you to see mine as yours. That kind of love is... it requires you to be able to break open your heart and take in other people's grief and still show up for each other and care for each other and go on with each other. And I think that kind of love is the only thing that will transition us.
Yeah, I think so too. And the terrible beauty of it is you don't get to see that unless you walk through that particular fire. Where you and I are so very different in terms of where we come from and what we look like and the various privilege or not privilege we've had. And yet I could read this book and just sort of feel this overwhelming sense of kinship and sort of just knowing that we were going to have a conversation that would actually mean something.
And I can't tell you, Kelly, I think this whole conversation that we've been having, part of my heart is still back in the image that you gave us of sitting by your daughter's side and feeding her mm-hmm. in her final days.
Yeah. This stuff ain't easy.
No.
And no one said it was going to be.
No.
And so you
and for each other like that.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the here's what I know, having gone through the I was prepared for the caregiving. My improv background, my community, my ability to, I was prepared for that and handled it. I did not know what the grief journey would look like. Mm-hmm. I'd never experienced anything like that. But it was not unlike the caregiving experience in that my darkest moments were when I felt complete disconnection. And I found myself, my new self or the self without Nora, you know, the family that went from 4 to 3. Mm-hmm. I found that in connection with that same community that carried us through before, and even new people who showed up. And it required both us putting ourselves out there, but also the willingness to sort of accept the invitation into someone truly seeing us. It's interesting, I have this whole project that I lead at the University of Chicago, which is behavioral science and improvisation. And we talk in improv about how you need to focus on others, be others focused as a way to understand. And they pointed to a piece of evidence called self-verification theory. Mm-hmm. And you actually bring it up in the book, but not based on this. But the idea in self-verification theory is we actually don't care that much that you see us as our prettiest selves or smartest selves. We want you to see us as we see ourselves.
Yes. Yes.
Which is not always pretty.
Yes.
But that's not the way we think we want to see it, but it is true. At least the social science says it, and I believe it to be true too.
Yes. To see each other that fully, that wholly, in all of our humanness. And then for so many of us who are people of color or women of color who are constantly fed messages that you are not good enough or smart enough or strong enough or fair enough or beautiful enough or whatever it is, to know that we are still enough and all of what we are. I feel like my life has also been a battle of quieting the little critic in my own mind.
Yeah.
And letting, Audre Lorde says, we can learn how to mother ourselves, right? How do I see myself through the eyes of a mother and all of my imperfections and all of my woundedness and say, oh, but you are still beloved the way you might tell your daughter or I might tell mine.
Yeah. We always end the podcast asking for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, which is groups of people making something out of nothing, you actually get nowhere by saying no. And you actually don't get that far by saying yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten, which is the heart of improvisation. Your life feels like a giant yes and to me, but I am going to ask you for a yes and story. It can be from the book. It can be from anything.
Oh, you know, and I'm so new to improv. And so you're teaching me this terminology. I'm like, yes, listening, that's my life. Yes, yes, and that's also my life. Who knew that I was living my life according to the rules of improv? I think the story that I'd like to share was one I keep returning to these days when things feel so hard. It was election night, 2016, and we're watching the results come in, and grief seizing my throat, horror is coming over me. And my son, who was at that point 2 years old, tugged at my sleeve and said, "Mommy, dance time?" And I thought, dance time on a night like this? And my husband, I was waiting for an out. And my husband's like, you know, my husband shrugs and says, "Your rules, you said every night." So it wasn't a no, it was a yes. And we turned down the volume and we turned up, "Baby, you're a firework." And at first I am just so miserable, Kelly. I'm just like swaying back and forth, and I'm looking, and suddenly my son leaps into my arms and he's shouting and saying, "Throw me up, mommy," and boom, 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 even brighter than the moon. And I'm throwing him up and I'm laughing and he's dancing and I'm dancing. And Kelly, I was dancing on election night.
Yep.
And afterwards, I felt this energy rise in me. And I thought, joy, you know, I think joy is our greatest act of moral resistance. Like, joy returns us to everything that is good and beautiful and worth fighting for. Joy gives us energy for that long and hard labor. I believe laboring in joy is the meaning of life. And so we have dance time every night now in this house. Mm-hmm. No matter how hard or dark or miserable the days are, we still labor in joy.
The book is called See No Stranger, A Memoir and Manifesto of Revolutionary Love. Valerie Kaur, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Kelly.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.